Chapter 14, 1 Samuel 14. In 1862, Abraham Lincoln removed General Ambrose Burnside from command after the Battle of Fredericksburg, describing his actions as snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. And there's a sort of whiff, shall we say, of that in chapter 14. In chapter 13, just to remind you of the background, the Israelites face extinction. They have no prophet. Samuel has left. They have no word from God, no promises brought to them from God. And they have no army. Everyone has gone. They're down to 600 men. They have no weapons because of the closing down of all the blacksmiths in the land by the Philistines. And they have a rejected king to lead them. And the last verse of chapter 13, it paints a very bleak picture. We expect to read the worst in chapter 14, only surprise, surprise, we meet with the opposite. An astonishing reversal of all our expectations, which are all tragically spoiled by Saul. So our subject is victory and stupidity. Victory and stupidity. We note first of all, from verse 1 to verse 23, the courage of faith. The courage of faith. And I've tried to alliterate everything to help us just to follow through. There are a number of things that we are told here in these 23 verses regarding the courage of faith. We note first of all in verses 1 to 5 the context of faith. The context of faith. The writer paints for us a most remarkable picture. The description begins at verse 1. Came to pass upon a certain day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said unto the young man that bare his armor, come, and let us go over to the Philistines' garrison. But then he digresses to flesh out this context, and he returns to the same point in verse 6. So you have a repetition of the words of verse 1 and verse 6. So the writer is saying to us, well, here's this little vignette within the bigger picture, and you need to grasp the context of all that's going to happen after this point. So you have Jonathan's initiative in verse 1. Come and let us go over to the camp of the Philistines. By contrast, you have Saul's inertia in verse 2. What is Saul doing? He's sitting under a pomegranate tree. What a remarkable image is put before us. What an amazing description. You have this initiative taken by Jonathan, the courage of faith. What's Saul doing? He's loafing under a tree. And with him, we're told, is a hireling. And this third verse is most important also. The writer wants to remind you of the dark days of chapter 4. Remember chapter 4, Ichabod, the glory is departed. And the writer is saying, do you see who's here with Saul, Ahab? How fascinating this all is. You have a rejected dynasty in the form of Saul, with a rejected priesthood in the form of Ahab, and they're loafing under a pomegranate tree together. Blakey makes this fascinating comment. Saul was like the church at Sardis. Thou hast the name that thou livest and art dead. He's got the name of a king. What's he doing? Nothing. He's got a priest beside him. What's he doing? Nothing. A rejected dynasty and a rejected priesthood loafing together under a pomegranate tree. Isn't it interesting just the way the writer puts that? Under a pomegranate tree. But you know, Saul is not the only problem. The writer goes on to tell us in verse 4 and 5 of the geography. So he's now telling us that the geography was a problem and an obstacle as well. So you've got the problem of Saul's inertia. You've also got the problem of geography. Between Jonathan and the Philistine garrison was a passage towards Michmash, and it's described as a sharp rock on one side and a sharp rock on the other, and we're told their names, Bozez Sena. Bozez means glistening. Perhaps we might say it is a slippery place. And then there is Sena, which means thorny. The point is, the writer wants you to see the obstacles in the way to Jonathan's faith. The whole context of his faith is one of obstacles of Saul and geography. So Saul is an obstacle and the landscape is against him as well. That's the context of Jonathan's faith. But then from verses 6 to 10, we have the content of Jonathan's faith. We note his description of the Philistines. He says the garrison of the uncircumcised. In other words, here were people outside the covenant. They're therefore outside the commonwealth of Israel. These are not the people of God. They're the enemies of God. They're not Jonathan's enemies, per se. But they're strangers to God. They're enemies to the commonwealth of Israel. So they are an affront to God. Remember when David went out to meet Goliath? How did he speak of him? He speaks of him as that uncircumcised Philistine. The uncircumcised being met with the circumcised. The enemy facing the people of God. So this is Jonathan expressing his faith. Who are we fighting against? We're fighting against the uncircumcised. And we also note his view of God. It may be the Lord will work for us. For there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or few. He says this God in me, sir. This God is supreme. He can save by a handful or by many. Numbers don't matter to God. If only we evangelicals would remember this. Numbers don't matter with God. Sometimes we think if only we have numbers. If only the cause of Christ had numbers. Well, Islam has numbers. Romanism has numbers. What do numbers matter? Jonathan says, God can save as many or few. And remember, he's speaking to his armor bearer. It's as if he's putting backbone into his armor bearer. As he says, come, let's go to these Philistines that are uncircumcised. And the God whom we serve, he is sovereign and all powerful. And there's also his supposition. The reasoning of Jonathan. He says, it may be that the Lord will work for us. It may be, perhaps, who knows, he's saying. In other words, we may not presume upon God, but we can venture for God. That's what he's saying. We can't presume, but we can go forward. We can venture. It's the reasoning of faith. It may be, perhaps. Who knows what the Lord will do? So they go forward. And Jonathan with faith says to his armor bearer, their answer will determine our position. What we will do. What the Lord will do. If they say to us, wait, we will come to you, then we'll stand our ground. We'll stand still. We'll stand our ground. It's a man of faith speaking. We'll just stand our ground. Let them come to us. Who knows what the Lord will do, even in that. But if they say, come to us, We will go because it is a sign of God's deliverance, that he has delivered the camp of the Philistines, the entire Philistine army, into our hands. What faith? Two men. And he says, if that's the answer, then we shall know the entire Philistine army is defeated. There's going to be a victory. And then in verses 11 to 14, we have the constancy of faith. It's all very well. Jonathan's saying, let's go forth. But sometimes we can waver in our faith. We can venture, and then we can suddenly say, oh, I don't know, maybe we got this wrong. Perhaps we should crawl back down into the hole we came out of. That's not what they do. Jonathan stands up, and it's interesting again, just the way the description is put before him. He didn't just appear. We are told that he climbed up upon his hands and upon his feet. The writer wants you to see him coming out of this passageway. Obviously they've been crawling along. And they get to the end and then they stand before the Philistines. The constancy of faith. He didn't just begin. He kept enduring and persevering. And of course the Philistines mock and they jeer at them. And they say, come on, they say, and we will teach you a few lessons. You see what they're saying. You come on up into our garrison and we'll teach you boys a thing or two. We'll teach you about manliness and warfare. And Jonathan immediately knew victory was his. And within a flash, they're all dead. Jonathan and his armor bearer, they kill all 20 of them. And again, you see the description. It's about the size of an acre of land what an oxen would plow. So it was quite a sizable garrison and quite a sizable battle that was going on even amongst them. Half an acre of land. 20 dead. So you can see, they leave the camp of Israel with all the obstacles. They go forth in faith. They persevere in faith. And then from verse 15 to 23, the consequences of faith. The repetition in verse 15 is a most significant point being made. The word trembling. Over and over, there was trembling in the host, in the field, and among all the people, the garrison and the spoilers. They also trembled, and the earth quaked. So it was also a very great trembling. What happened that day with that garrison set off a chain reaction? It had a ripple effect. Fear and panic just spread out right across the entire Philistine army. So we're told the host, the field, the garrison, the spoilers, even the earth trembled. Trembling was everywhere. And all this trembling, and all this fighting that broke out amongst them, it eventually reached Saul, who was still loafing under the pomegranate tree. The watchmen looked, and they looked in amazement because the army seemed to be falling back. It melted away. And we're told that they went beating down one another. They were fighting each other. And what is Saul's response? Who's missing? This is Saul's response. Who's missing? Let's have a head count. Let's call the roll of the 600 to find out who's missing. And then obviously remembering his previous mistakes, he thinks it's time for some religion, verses 18 and 19. We need a bit of religion here before joining in with the battle. But Saul isn't the only one who is energized as a consequence of this chain reaction set off by Jonathan. Those Hebrews who had switched their allegiance some time before, who were now part of the Philistine army, suddenly got some courage. And they switched back on their allegiance and started fighting the Philistines. And what is more, the rest who had hidden away, they found some courage too. And so they make an appearance and they join in with fighting against the Philistines. And the conclusion of this section is a theological point. It explains all that's happening. So the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle passed over on the Beth Avon. It vindicates Jonathan's faith. It vindicates Jonathan's faith. The courage of his faith. He went forth out into the camp of the Philistines. And the Lord created this ripple effect throughout the whole host. And fear gripped the whole lot of them. And they started stabbing each other and fighting each other. And the whole situation was reversed. Now go back to chapter 13, when we saw everything collapsing. We look towards the future at the end of chapter 13, and it seemed as if it's all over and finished. But Jonathan didn't think like that. The Lord, who knows what the Lord can do? Who knows what he can do with a few? Let's venture. Maybe the Lord will work. If the narrative and history had ended at verse 23, it would be a great conclusion. What a way to finish that history. But it doesn't end there. From verse 24 to verse 46, we have, secondly, the tragedy of stupidity. The tragedy of stupidity. While all this is going on, something else is happening at the same time. And the gloss is taken off the victory by Saul's stupidity. And we note three things here. We note, first of all, hindering the battle in verses 24 to 30. Napoleon once said, an army marches on its stomach. Saul says, an army will fight better when it's hungry. Jonathan agrees, shall we say, with Napoleon, according to verse 30. How much more if happily the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies which they found. For had there not been now a much greater slaughter among the Philistines. Oh, the stupidity of this rule, he says. The stupidity of Saul. If there hadn't been such stupidity. Think how much greater our victory would have been. But Saul has hindered the victory. He has spoiled the victory. He has held things back. So there's hindering the battle. And then in verses 31 to 35, fastidious over ritual. As a consequence of Saul's stupidity, when an opportunity came for them to eat, principle was abandoned. And suddenly Saul gets all legalistic and graphic about it all. Roll a great stone towards me. Oh, this was all awful. It's a bit late now to start getting fastidious about ritual. When he should have cared, he didn't care. When he should have been sensible, he wasn't sensible. And now he is all finickety, isn't it? And thirdly, looking for a scapegoat in verses 36 to 46. When God refused to answer Saul at the end of verse 37, Saul starts to look for someone to blame. And astonishingly, Jonathan is the one who ends up in trouble. And all Jonathan can think of that he had done wrong that day was that he ate some honey. And Saul, in his stupidity, his crazed stupidity, is fully prepared to have him executed. The very instrument of victory and faith, because he broke some tyrannical rule. What twisted reasoning exists in the mind of Saul? You see, Saul's twisted reasoning goes something like this. God didn't answer me, verse 37, because of what others did, verse 32. And what the others did in verse 32 was because of what Jonathan had done before that. In other words, you have to reason backwards to understand what Saul is getting at. He's looking for a scapegoat. I'm not to blame. Jonathan's to blame. It didn't seem to cross his mind that Samuel was the bearer of God's word and Samuel was absent. So the fact that the Lord didn't answer him meant he should have sent for Samuel. Is there any word from the Lord? But he didn't. And for once, the people refused to let Saul carry out his threat. How interesting. Verse 46. The great plan of Saul. Let's fight these Philistines all night until the morning. The plan came to nothing. Saul went up from following the Philistines. And the Philistines went to their own place. What a twisted kind of a king Saul is. And how stupid Saul is as a king. And then thirdly, in verses 46 to 52, the record of history. The record of history. The writer tells us that Saul took the kingdom and that he fought successfully against every enemy, Moab, Ammon, Edom, Zobah, Philistines, not forgetting the Amalekites in particular. The writer goes on to tell us that he had three sons and two daughters. We're also told that his army was led by Abner, and who Abner was related to. And just as this history began, so it ends in verse 51 by telling us about his lineage. And if you go back to the start of this whole section, it starts with Saul's lineage. Saul, the son of Kish. And there's a postscript to it in verse 52. There was sore war against the Philistines all the days of Saul. And then we're told how he looked out for valiant men to become part of his army. So the writer then is completing, as it were, the history of Saul. When I know that Saul is a one-term king. We also know what kind of character he is. It's a rejected dynasty. And what follows is proof of his twistedness. In chapter 15. Chapter 15 will give us the clear demonstration that God had rejected this man. And yet, as we always get in all these sections regarding these rulers and kings, there's that record of history which acknowledges that after this singular victory, he continued to have success in battle. And that's what we're told in verse
48. He delivered Israel out of the hands of them that spoiled him. Fraser doesn't shy away from telling us that. He doesn't say, well, he's rejected, so we'll just rubbish all his deeds. No, it says, this is the record. This is what he achieved. This is what he did. But to understand what God thought of him, we need chapter 15. Well, what are the lessons for us? Well, first of all, we have here an example of faith in the midst of every obstacle. Jonathan is a contrast to Saul, and the significance of that we'll see in a moment or two. But Jonathan is a contrast to Saul. If you look at chapter 13, verses 1 to 3, you have that same contrast. The first two verses, we've got Saul, inactive. Verse 3, Saul smiting the garrison of the Philistines. Chapter 14, verse 1, you have Jonathan going forth to smite the Philistines. And what's Saul doing? He's loping around. In other words, the writer is showing to us that faith energizes God's people. It doesn't apathize God's people. Faith works rather than wilts. And our faith relates to how well we know God. The people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. So Jonathan knew God. And Jonathan acts on that knowledge that they had of God. You know, friends, when faith is weak, we are weak. And weak faith doubts God. That's what weak faith does. When our faith is weak, we hesitate to venture. We hesitate to go forward. Because of all kinds of doubts about God. Jonathan is an example of faith. He knows God. He acts on the knowledge of God. If that means us two going out into a garrison of this huge army of Philistines. Remember the 30,000 chariots in themselves. Not to mention a number of foot soldiers that it wasn't possible to count on that time. But he ventures forth. Faith is the answer. He knew God. He said, God, you can overthrow these Philistines with 2 or 2,000. It matters not with God. So he says to his armor bearer, let you and I go off into these, amongst these Philistines. But then secondly, you can be surrounded with the trappings of religion and yet be a stranger to God. You can be surrounded with the trappings of religion and yet be a stranger to God. To put it another way, you can have the symbols of faith and not have the reality of faith. Saul has the symbols of faith. He has the priest. And he has the ark. He's got the symbols of faith. But he was a stranger to God. You get it in Judas. You get it in Simon. It's the problem of 1 Corinthians chapter 10, isn't it? You can experience, as it were, the Exodus and eat the manna and drink the water from the rock and yet remain in unbelief. That's what happened to a lot of these Israelites. They experienced the Exodus. They ate the manna. They drank water from the rock, but they were in unbelief. Saul can have the priest of Shiloh in verse 3, have the ark in his presence in verse 18, put himself to extremities in verse 33. He can build an altar to God in verse 35, and yet be a stranger to God in verse 37. God doesn't talk to him. It's the great tragedy of Saul. And we have an illustration of this, don't we, from Bunyan in Pilgrim's Progress. Remember how he describes ignorance? Ignorance says, I have eaten and drunken in the king's presence, and he has taught in our streets. Then they asked ignorance for a scroll. So he fumbled in his chest pocket and found none. Then Bunyan adds this dreadful sentence. Then I saw there was a way to hell, even from the gates of heaven. A way to hell, even from the gates of heaven. Saul had all the trappings of religion, but he was a stranger to God. That's a great tragedy, isn't it? That's an awful tragedy. You can have all the symbols and all the signs and not have the reality. But then thirdly, just standing back a little from all of the verses, Jonathan, an example of humble service. Jonathan, an example of humble service. What do I mean? Well, ordinarily, Jonathan would have succeeded Saul as king. But because of Saul's sin, that was never going to happen. Jonathan was never going to be king. Some would say, well, if that's the case, they would get a chip on their shoulder and get miffed and say, well, I'm not going to do any serving. I'm never going to be king. Why should I bother to help these Israelites? Because I'm not going to be king. But Jonathan never said that. Now, there are some who might argue, but this is unfair to Jonathan. Why should Jonathan suffer because of Saul? Why should his place be removed because of what Saul did? Isn't that a bit unfair? It is the case that the sins of the fathers is sometimes experienced in the lives of the children. But even if this were not so, you need to remember that the throne of Israel and the kingdom of Israel didn't belong to Saul, and they didn't belong to Jonathan. They didn't belong to anyone. They belonged to God. It was God's kingdom and God's throne. It was up to God to determine who would sit on his throne in his kingdom. So it wasn't Jonathan's to take. He had no automatic right to kingship. Nevertheless, what is particularly striking is how Jonathan serves the kingdom, even though he's never going to be king. And how few there are who are content to serve without ever being king, as it were, or anything equivalent. How many there are who only serve because they strive for kingship, and if that option is closed to them, they'll say, well, I'm not serving. Jonathan's a reminder. God's kingdom, it matters more than personal rewards or ambition. He will keep on serving the Lord. It's God's kingdom. So that description of the Philistines as uncircumcised, he doesn't say these are my enemies or these are Saul's enemies. These are God's enemies. That's what matters. And I'm here to serve Israel. And even when Jonathan is explaining to the people the folly of Saul, what does he say? He says, how much greater the slaughter of the Philistines would have been. My father has troubled the land, he says. What an utter fool. Doesn't he realize it's the Lord's battle It's the Lord's kingdom. We are the servants of the Most High God. That's who Jonathan is serving. He's not serving Saul. He's serving God. And he is content, as it were, to play second fiddle. He's content to serve. Though he will never be king. He's a better king than Saul, isn't he? But he's just never going to wear the crown. And there is something delightful about Jonathan. In fact, that stance of Jonathan's, you're going to see come up time after time. When David is king, Jonathan is there supporting David. So here is David sitting on the throne that Saul sat on, that Jonathan's never going to sit on. But he's never envious. He's no angst. He's no axe to grind. He's just happy to serve the Lord. Even if that means he's still an ordinary person. He's never going to be great. Never going to have a crown. Never going to be bowed to by anyone. But he's just happy to serve the Lord. And then finally, in light of those last verses of chapter 14, that record of history, all human success must be weighed against covenant faithfulness. Saul has many human achievements, and they're all given to us here. What is the writer saying to us? He may have human success, but he's a tragedy. He is marked by covenant unfaithfulness, covenant rebellion. So Saul remains a tragic figure who cannot undo the curse of God despite all his successes. No matter how much he achieves, he will never earn enough or merit enough to remove the curse of God. His achievements cannot buy God's favour. He's never going to undo that curse of God that hangs over history, where God says, you're a one-time king, a one-term king. Your dynasty is cursed. You won't have a successor. And so when the writer sandwiches, as it were, this section between the previous chapter and chapter 15, and it's the bridge between these two sections, so you have all that curse that comes before, all Saul's twistedness, and then the writer says, now, put this section here, the record of history. All this human success, will it undo this? Does it mean he's a better person? The writer says, see what follows. See how the construction's always important. The way things are laid side by side. The writer is saying to us, do you see this contrast? He may have human success. He may have many worldly achievements. But they mean nothing when weighed by the covenant. He's a failure. It is all ashes. That's what it amounts to. For he has achieved it all without God. As we look at this life of Saul's, we cannot help be struck by that contrast between Jonathan and Saul. One has faith. The other had success. One had no crown. The other wore the crown. But it was Jonathan who ventured for the Lord. May God bless his word to our hearts.